You're listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. Hosted by business and political expert Jay Amernick, political visionary and entrepreneur Rick Raddatz, and me, journalist in all media, Heather Vail, The Political Fix reveals the answers we're all looking for. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, at politicalfixradio.com. And welcome to The Political Fix on this Wednesday, January the 21st. I'm Heather Vail, here with my co-hosts Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. Jay is a strategic planner who helps his clients create and implement plans, goals, tactics, and benchmarks. And he also serves as the bridge in Nevada for Israeli companies who want to expand their business in the U.S. He also has a development lab that creates smartphone apps and inventions. Rick Raddatz is a serial entrepreneur and internet marketer with a degree in philosophy. His political development's called The Solution, which is to cap and prioritize government spending. I'm Heather Vail, also known as The Unwrapper, a premier freelance interviewer and journalist in all media. Hey guys, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi there.
Good morning. Jay, how are things going in your world?
Good, very busy. I'm starting to realize that from November through about January are a very hectic time for me, you know, between doing Toys for Tots stuff, planning for CES, and then the aftermath of CES, which I'm still involved with. So I have to sort of plan that out a little bit better.
All right, not
take on so much in January.
Well, January is the month to take stuff on. I mean, it's a psychological mindset. It's a new year. Time to accomplish new things. And speaking of that, Rick, I'm assuming that you've got some news for us because you seem to be out there all the time these days, hustling and bustling. So what's going on?
Yes, I am signed up as a lobbyist for this new political movement called Convention of States. And, okay, I got my volume set there.
Where are you calling?
Are you in a janitor's closet or something?
Yes, I've fallen from my peak 2 weeks ago when I was very newscasterish. Now I'm part of the basement underground movement.
I see that. All right.
Welcome to the world of politics.
So tell us more about lobbying from the janitor's closet.
Yeah. So. Yeah, this is my office at the state capitol. They don't know that I'm here. This is my storage room in my house. I have my old trophies from high school over there, and so on. Some paint for all the different rooms in the house, which we would never know which paint matched what wall, of course, and other things. But what should be behind me is a nice green screen. I couldn't quite get assembled, and all the electronics working this morning in time, and then I ran. I lost track of time and ran out of time, and so you get this. But in terms of the lobbying effort, it's been going great. The movement is called Convention of States, and if you go to conventionofstates.com, you can sign the petition for it. It's a nationwide movement. 430,000 people have signed the petition so far. So it's real. This is about the states coming together to call a convention, and at that convention, the delegates will work together to propose amendments to the U.S. Constitution, and this will all be on the topic of limiting the federal government. Now, think about this. If the states limit the federal government, the states do not have the incentive to screw themselves like the federal government, you know, often screws the states with unfunded mandates and all these strings attached and so on, right? So if the states are calling this convention to amend the federal constitution, what the states are going to do, it's in their incentive, is to bring the power back home to the states where it was originally. And then the states can decide how they want to spend that money. The states can prioritize. So this is still the cap and prioritize reform that we've been talking about for 6 months now. But now this is an actual movement that has a chance of making it happen in our lifetime. And so that's why I'm involved now full time. So conventionofstates.com.
Okay, so once the states get the power back, then you have to go to each state and convince them that cap and prioritize is the way to go?
No, the cap will already have happened because that will be what the states do to the federal government. They'll cap the federal government. And then
we're hoping that they'll just prioritize naturally.
Well, what we'll have is we'll have 50 different experiments for how to prioritize.
So, but how do you know that they will prioritize?
What else can they do but prioritize?
They have no other choice. No. It will be a failed state if they do not.
So, in other words, there's no point in even talking about this anymore, because if it's just going to happen and nobody has a choice and it just naturally will progress, why are we even having this show? Why are we even talking about this?
Well, because it hasn't happened yet. We still need 34 states total to apply to Congress, which will then force Congress to call a convention. That's the actual terminology there. And so far we have 3 states, Georgia, Alaska, and Florida. Okay, so we have 2 right-leaning states, and Florida's kind of a toss-up state. And this year, that happened last year. So this year, the thinking is that there's about 39 states total in play, counting the 3 that we already got. So who knows if we'll get 10 or 15 or 20 or 34 states this year, but there's a lot of momentum behind this. But it hasn't happened yet. So the reason why we can't just all sit back and say, wow, it's been solved, is that we still have to go through the process. Now we have a clear path. And so the cap and prioritize movement now has a much more credible story of how it's going to happen.
Okay, who exactly do you need to talk to in order to get the states on board? Who's in charge of saying, yes, my state's on board?
Well, the state legislatures of every state have to basically pass a resolution applying to Congress to call the convention. And the resolution has to be the same or pretty much the same in all 34 states, because otherwise they're calling for a different convention. So, for example, the balanced budget amendment people have already gotten 34 states to apply for a convention to the federal government be limited under a balanced budget amendment. However, it took them 40 years to do it, and in that time, 10 states have reversed themselves. Okay, so there's still 10 states short. But that's an example of the most successful attempt at having a states convention or convention of states. This movement is just 18 months old. We already have 3. We're looking at another 10 to 20 to maybe 34 this year. So we have some momentum, and all of the resolutions being proposed in all the different states are the same language. So when it comes time for Congress to sort all these requests, they're all end up in one pile.
Okay. So are you going from state to state lobbying,
or
are
no,
you
no, just? No, I'm the Colorado lobbyist. I'm the legislative liaison for the Convention of States project in Colorado. So I spend my days now at the Capitol here in Denver, and I just walk door to door, passing out literature, setting up meetings, and then we have a state director who is in charge of the grassroots. And so her job is not only to recruit the grassroots, but then if I say, boy, we need a lot of heat focused on Senator so-and-so, then she goes out there, gets the people in that district to write in with the right language, maybe even people from around the state to write in, depending on the situation. And so we're kind of, it's a full-scale operation.
Okay. Jay, do you have any commentary on all this?
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. It's also interesting that, when you pointed out the other movement where some states got on board and then dropped off, speaks to the very nature of our political system as you're sort of working on one piece of it. Elections happen in another state, it changes the makeup of the state legislature, and then they drop off, or other things can happen. The governor of a particular state can sort of really, really try to put the kibosh on it and a lot of other things. I mean, there are a lot of challenges with this, and as Rick suggests, is a grassroots effort. I think it's the precarious nature of politics.
Okay. So is this how you would suggest going about it? I mean, you've had experience with the whole lobby thing.
As a strategy, yes. We can sort of drill down on tactics, later, I mean, there's some specific things that made, you know, I worked for AIPAC, which is the most effective foreign policy lobby in the country, and then basically the world. But we focus on the U.S. government. And there were certain things that we did and certain sort of things that were baked into our philosophy of how to go about it that that is what made it and still makes it to this day so successful.
Okay.
So, but that's all right. That it may be like a sort of off camera conversation.
Sure. Yeah. I'll talk to you afterwards.
All right. Okay. So let's have the top story, and then after I tell you the top story, we will take a break, and then we'll come back and discuss it.
Very
good. So
wait.
What?
Don't we have to guess what the top story is first?
Oh, okay. Yeah, go ahead and guess.
I can. Come on, really?
Yeah. Right.
I think Obama made a speech.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jay.
All right. Yeah.
Ding, ding, ding.
I believe we lost the. You guys still in the hangout?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, you. Well, yeah, you froze. All right. Well. Anyway, we can still hear you. So. All right. So out of Washington.
I'll try to get back on.
President Barack Obama's State of the Union address yesterday marked a sweet spot in his presidency when economic signs and his own personal approval are on the rise. He made sure to capitalize, taking credit for policies he said raised the country out of its recession. But sweet spots are fleeting and can just as quickly sour. Obama's speech capped a remarkably activist 11 weeks since Obama suffered Democratic losses that gave Republicans control of both chambers of Congress. But this was not a lessons learned address. Instead, Obama drew lines in the sand that cautioned against Republican overreach. And while he offered a nod to bipartisanship on issues such as trade, he pushed a traditional Democratic economic agenda of tax increases for the rich, expanded paid leave for workers, and increased aid for education. For a president who's 2 months removed from a devastating political loss, he was pretty bold and brash against his critics. The White House is betting that by promoting the economic successes and taking credit for them, Obama will be able to weaken Republican resolve to undo his initiatives on immigration, climate change, and Cuba. It's a better bet today than it was last year or the year before that, but the global economy remains fragile. A Washington Post ABC News poll released yesterday showed Obama with an approval rating of 50%, the poll's highest rating for the president in more than 18 months. But that support is still largely from the groups that backed his presidential campaigns in the first place, Democrats, moderates, Hispanics, and younger people. Cheaper gas, lower employment, and a strong stock market have contributed to the good feelings. So have issues that Obama has pushed that appeal specifically to those groups, such as shielding more than 4 million immigrants from deportation and calling for free community college for all. But the success of Obama's remaining 2 years also depends on his relations with the ruling Republicans in Congress. Obama cited trade as one of the most prominent topics that could attract bipartisan support. He wants to conclude two major commerce agreements, one with Europe and one with countries on the Pacific Rim. Now, that's where Democrats and his allies in organized labor abandon him. So to succeed, Obama's going to have to risk taking a hit on his own approval ratings. Republicans began the year by seeking to undo Obama's immigration initiative, weaken provisions in the 2010 financial regulations law, and force approval of the Keystone XL oil pipeline from Canada. Obama countered with 7 veto threats in quick succession, including 2 on the very day of his State of the Union address. All right, so we're taking a quick break. We're coming back in 2 minutes, and we'll talk about the top story. So we'll be right back with you on The Political Fix. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail here with my co-hosts Rick Raddatz and Jay Amernick. Before the break, we heard the top story, which is an analysis of Barack Obama's State of the Union address, which took place yesterday. Jay, do you have any commentary on the top story?
Yes, I do. And I'd actually like to start with foreign policy, because that's kind of my area of expertise. His foreign policy is from soup to nuts a complete disaster.
Don't pull any punches here or anything.
I actually am pulling punches. That's me being kind. I didn't use the word delusional. But threatening to veto a sanctions bill on Iran that enjoys wide bipartisan support is foolish as a political move, and it is incredibly dangerous as a policy move. I really don't understand exactly what he's trying to gain from it. If he really believes that negotiating with Iran is going to work and be successful, I really can't help you when this is your advisor and he leaves your organization. That means you've really done because he is one of the most common and voices.
All right, Jay, we're losing you. I'm going to let Doug reconnect you. And in the meantime, Rick, what do you think?
It's the breakup of Jay. Well, I will use the word delusional. Because the philosophy is wrong. He is deluding himself and the nation, if I'm using the word right. His foreign policy comes from a very naive point of view. Here's the thing I can't tell. Is he saying it because it's what the American people want to hear, or at least his base wants to hear? Or does he actually believe this stuff? I mean, my goodness. It seems so obvious that some of the – what's interesting about presidential politics is that when the next party gets elected in the presidential office, the reality often hits them. And regardless of what was said in the campaign trail, they tend to continue the policies of their past the past occupant of the White House, just because they understand now what's really going on. And what's weird here is that Obama has done that in practice in a lot of ways, but then diverted from it in a lot of amazing ways that could just be very easy things for him to do right. So it's just mind-boggling. I have to believe it has a lot to do with the fact that we have this left-right divide in this country that is based on an honest confusion about what the right answer is. And so that allows people on both sides to be more confident in their wrong approach because no one knows a better approach. And so that's where things like Camp and Prioritize, after they take root and they solve social justice within libertarian limits, let's say generations from now, maybe some of the benefit will spill over in the foreign policy for two reasons. One, other nations might copy us and solve their problems too and thus be more aligned, especially the poor democracies. And two, maybe just our own internal conflict will be less so that we can be actually more analytical and pragmatic about our policies instead of political.
Okay. So, Jay, Rick actually called the president delusional. And
okay.
We lost you in the middle of your commentary, unfortunately. So you can just
okay. Yeah. So yeah, I will add to the. I won't use the word delusional, but I will, you know, tell you how to spell it. when he says that the shadow of crisis is behind us, literally just last week, 2,000 people were butchered by Boko Haram. Yesterday there was a terrorist attack in Tel Aviv where 11 people were stabbed to death. Actually, I don't know if they were stabbed. So to say the shadow of crisis behind us is does fall into the delusional category. I'll take a little pot shot at the president here. I take exception with him in his president of the United States should not be quoting other people. People should be quoting our president. He quoted the Pope in his speech. He should have had better writers coming up with a better line than the Pope did to describe what he wanted to describe. And that is my one pot shot.
Well, he probably thinks that the Pope has some credibility among the people of the states that he wants to leverage.
No. But again, I criticized President George W. Bush when he did it too. The President of the United States should not quote other people in a speech. He should be the one being quoted.
It's a very Christian skewed country, so to quote the Pope will get a lot of people's attention.
It got my attention, but it also gave me some ammunition, which I wasn't really looking for.
Okay, but you're probably one of a fraction of a percent of people who are saying, "How dare he quote the Pope?"
I didn't say how dare he, and it's not saying I quote the Pope. It is that the President of the United States, I'm saying, shouldn't
quote anybody.
Be quoting other people in a speech, he should be the one being quoted. And if he's quoting other people, he should hire better writers who can come up with something better than what the Pope said. And it's not a bad. I mean, it wasn't like a earth shattering quote either. I mean, it's not like it was like an Oscar Wilde epitome. It was like a little nothing. I'm surprised that he even used it, but he did. And the reason I got a copy of the speech well beforehand. Well, once the embargo was lifted, I got it. Because I'm that cool.
You also mentioned minimum wage again, calling for, saying that people can't live on $15,000 a year. Go try it. And then I saw one economist, Don Boudreau, who is in favor of cap and prioritize, talk about on his blog how, well, the other impact of minimum wage is that people who don't produce that much value to their employers end up losing a job. So try living on $0 a year. Let's give those people a raise by letting them earn whatever income they can, getting job experience and moving up the ladder. Because, except for very rare circumstances, people don't stay a minimum wage for very long. If there's any competency at all, or willpower, or drive, etc. So, if you just let the free market work in this case, you're going to maximize the benefit to the poorest. In parallel, let's have a capped and prioritized social spending budget via the government, because unavoidably, government's going to be in that business just because of the right to vote. But if it's capped and prioritized, that money can fund programs that give them right education, clothing, healthcare, etc. for short term, as they transition out of that job into a better one because they've earned it. So that's the comprehensive solution: free up the capitalism and make government more efficient and effective.
Right.
Yeah. The minimum wage debate has been going on for some time, but
decades.
When we have McDonald's workers claiming that they should be paid $15 an hour, that's crazy.
Robot costs a lot less these days. Yeah, and it's coming. It is coming.
Yeah, I don't see how. I mean, and typically it's teenagers or it's people that are going through a transition period that will take those jobs. So,
that's absolutely right.
The coming computer automation revolution, and we're just in the beginning of it, okay? As that starts to replace the entry-level jobs, this is going to be a transformative point for our nation and the world, one way or the other, because there is going to be a lot of people who suddenly cannot earn a salary out of merit, a lot of people. And they're going to need re-education, to use a very dangerous term. But they're going to need to be educated in some fashion that leads to productivity and, productive work that people want to pay for. So, and it's only going to get worse. It's only going to get worse because for the last couple hundred years since the Industrial Revolution, machines have really augmented human endeavors. And so if you replace a farmer with a farmer plus a tractor, and you free up the farmers to become, doctors and dentists and lawyers and maybe not lawyers, but whatever, that it's pretty clear how to see how that's a net benefit to society. But now the computers and automation are getting so advanced as they can actually replace humans. I don't see the obvious place where those unskilled, uneducated laborers are going to be able to earn minimum wage. Scary.
You think they're going to earn less than minimum wage?
Well, if there's a minimum wage law, they'll just be unemployed at that point.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And, no one's going to hire them, right? Okay.
Yeah. And, through globalization, we the world, all benefit from hiring people in backwards countries to do things at a price that they wouldn't do in a more advanced country. The poor people there get a better job than they had otherwise. Otherwise, why would they take it? And the world as a whole gets things that apparently they want. But even that is, we can start to see how we've colonized in that way a large part of the world. And so, how many more generations will that pool of low income labor exist? It's going to be mixed in with automation as well, and we got to solve these problems.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
Is it? Are we taking a break?
Hey, go ahead. Say something quick, and then we'll take a break.
You brought the example of McDonald's, and actually there's opportunity there even for the low income minimum wage worker. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and there was a McDonald's that was owned by a group of, I believe they were from Vietnamese immigrants. They had all started off working in the McDonald's, in another McDonald's, and then they finally were able to kind of get together, pull their money, and they bought themselves a franchise, and they were now all business owners. Mm-hmm. So they were able to move themselves out of that category. And it just took a matter of them having a little bit of gumption and nerve. There's actually a quote by John D. Rockefeller. He says, "Don't be afraid to give up the good to go for the great," which is exactly what they did.
Right. Now, typically, the people that are working in minimum wage jobs don't have that drive and ambition. Immigrants tend to be a different case because they came here with that drive and ambition to create a new life.
Right.
And it's a good point that Rick has. If let's say McDonald's workers and Walmart workers were making $15 an hour across the board, then a lot of those people would be displaced, because I know people that will work for $15 an hour who are a lot more qualified. So they're going to come in and get those jobs. And the people that were complaining about not making enough all of a sudden don't have a job.
Yeah, that's a really, really, really good point. Heather just made a really, really good point, is that it's not the same worker necessarily. If you force the price to be higher, you're going to get the employer is going to choose different people too.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have Inside Perspective with Jay Amernick. So we'll be back with you in a few minutes on The Political Fix. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail here with my co-hosts, Rick Raddatz, and yes, now we do have Jay Amernick. We lost him during the break a couple times, but he's back. And this is the time for the segment that we call Inside Perspective with Jay Amernick. So go ahead, Jay, take it away.
Thank you. And perhaps if I join the video call, you'll see the visuals. But this actually ties into a little bit to what we're talking about. I mentioned before that I was at CES for the past, 2 weeks ago. And we talk about the 50 states having 50 different experiments. That's kind of what CES is. It's this giant marketplace where you go in and okay, so the new hot thing, for instance, is 3D printing. Well, there's like a whole section of different vendors with their version of their 3D printer. Some are much better than others. Some are much cheaper than others. Some are better designed and so forth and so on. So what I found it actually, the whole thing very interesting, because it dawned on me that it was literally that you're going to have all these different versions of different things vying for the attention in a captain prioritized world. So what I think is going to be interesting is that the ones that actually perform and do better are going to last. It's like, it's almost like a Darwinism of ideas. This one group, they sold 3D printers, and they came in three different colors. They came in white, black, and then this hideous yellow. Oddly enough, the hideous yellow, the guy told me they're discontinuing. Right?
What a surprise.
Exactly. It didn't make the cut. And I couldn't figure out, like, why did they even have, you know, that yellow to begin with? And then I looked, like, the owner of the company's there, and he's wearing, like, this yellow tie. So clearly, like, that's his color, you know, and he threw it in. But he sort of made a classic error and put his own ego into it. A color which, when I worked in the world of retail, we used to call a dog. It was like that, you know, you had white, black, blue, you know, a red, and this, like that, and then just some off-base color that you knew you was never going to sell. It was going to be the one you marked down and had to basically give away. So that's what they were doing. It was the yellow one they were selling for a little bit cheaper because they were trying to get rid of them and they weren't going to continue that color anymore. So it already sort of happened within that company. They already capped and prioritized.
Yeah, but that's good for the consumer too, because then they get a deal on the technology if they can put up with the color.
No, you couldn't put up with this color. it struck me as so odd that this was like,
well, maybe you could use the 3D printer to build a shell for the 3D printer.
I don't know if I'd recommend that actually.
I was just kidding.
That was a joke, Jay.
I get it.
However, you know, they do make model paint that you can paint plastic, so you know.
Maybe they can make use a 3D printer to build a new cable modem or computer or both for Jay.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
And there's another thing,
Jay,
too. That, you know, one of the things that,
you're on the Hangout. Show us the visuals.
Okay. All right. So this is a keychain that was made with a 3D printer. Can you see it? It's actually a little more complicated than the things they were making last year. I know it doesn't look like it, but this has actually a moving piece in the middle of it. So that's already sort of leaps and bounds ahead of where we were last year with it. This is the other visual, if I get thrown off here real quick. This is a Lego duck, which is a model of a Lego duck that I made by moving my eye around the screen, by moving the Lego pieces, the virtual Lego pieces together. And this is the realized version of it. There it is. But the other thing I want to talk about actually is how the marketplace tries to come up with solutions to other problems. You know, one of the things that's coming down the pike with the aging population is the long-term care. So a lot of these technologies, we're talking about making people be able to stay in their homes longer, you know, without having to have you know, a long-term care facility, because the cost of that is astronomical. So coming up with a different solution other than a government, I don't want to say handout, but a government apparatus to make it so. So this is living proof of can prioritize working.
Yeah. Okay. Rick, do you have any commentary on Jay's inside perspective?
Well, yeah, when he says that capitalism is an example of cap and prioritize working, I think to be real specific there, capitalism is a competition between individuals for resources. And so when you have individuals competing for resources, the cap is actually protection of property rights. You need to stop people from stealing from each other. That way you know who owns what and you're comfortable and confident in your ownership of an item. And then the equivalent of prioritize is the free market. And the way that shapes out is that each individual prioritizes their own needs based on the pricing information that they see in front of them. And so it's in the case of capitalism, it ends up being about freedom in a sense, that, you know, the freedom to buy or not buy or to sell or not sell based on what your own priorities are. When it comes to the government, though, things change a little bit because it's not about free individuals competing for resources. It's about all the different ideas that we have for how government can help people competing for this limited pool of resources. And so when you have a limited pool of resources, you have to first agree on what the limit is, what the cap is, so you don't overtax the population and your economy. And then once you agree on that cap, then as a group, as a nation, as a collective, or in this case via our representatives, because that's the easiest way to do it, we need to agree on the priorities. Now, we'll never agree 100%, but notice also in capitalism, no one agrees 100%. We're all just trying stuff. And that's the same thing here with the government, is that we have to cap and prioritize and have that argument. And what will happen in time is the lowest priority stuff on average will fall off the cliff as new ideas come on board and take over that funding. And over time, you have this competition that constantly improves average government spending. That's the proper pursuit of social justice. And notice it does not work unless you have that cliff. You need a spending cap to act as a cliff that you can throw ideas off of as you have better ideas. So that's just to clarify the analogy that Jay made correctly between capitalism and cap and prioritize.
Okay.
Was it helpful?
You love the cliff metaphor, don't you?
I love that cliff metaphor. Now, does that cliff metaphor work, or is it just confusing?
Well, you know, first you're talking about basically throwing crap at the wall and seeing what sticks. And then it's like, okay, whatever doesn't stick, we'll just throw off the cliff. It's kind of funny.
Well, that's what it is.
What,
okay.
Jay?
Okay.
What did Jay say?
Jay, kill the hangout.
I would like to.
And just go on Skype.
Or phone, or whatever.
Yeah. I think his phone is VoIP. I think he has a limited internet connection, and the two together are competing.
No, I don't, because I do this all the time. No, I'm not. I do this all the time. It only happens to me, I swear to God, it only happens to me with Google Hangouts.
Okay.
I do this all the time with other like GoToMeeting type things and other apps.
All right.
That I have conference calls with.
All right, so we didn't hear what you were saying because it was all garbled, so why don't you try again?
I don't necessarily consider, you know, throwing it off the cliff necessarily, because that's kind of, I would say, like, put it on the back burner where it's not using any energy, and maybe you'll use it later, and if not, it's not taking up any space.
No, Rick wants to throw it off the cliff.
He wants to get rid of it forever.
Yeah.
But sometimes we learn things from what we've tossed.
Yeah, but
away.
Sometimes if you keep all the ideas on the back burner, mm-hmm. then your back burner ends up looking like Rick's environment right now.
As long as you know where everything is.
Yeah.
I have to say, though, Rick, you changed the lighting in there, and it actually looks kind of cool now.
You like it?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I turned on my studio lights. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, it looks much better. It actually.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of the hipster, you know, philosopher here. So
now you are, yeah.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the call, you just looked like you were in a janitor's closet, but now it's...
Okay. Yeah.
All right, guys. So let's take another quick break, and when we come back,
this is actually
a
green screen. I chose this background. You
oh,
like...
oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can see why you would want that background.
Yeah.
All right, we'll be back in a few minutes on the Political Fix. Welcome back to the Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail here with my co-host Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. And Rick has pulled the green screen out of his back pocket, and he is now sitting in front of a green screen. Ready for his rant. All right, so this is the segment we call the outside perspective, because as opposed to Jay's experience, up until now, Rick's been an outsider, but now I guess you're kind of becoming an insider too, Rick.
Yeah.
So I don't know what we're going to call this, but it's still, one way
it's
or another,
rant.
It's still Rick's rant. So
Rick's
go
rant.
Ahead.
Okay, 2 weeks ago on our last show, I ranted against the left for not living in reality. And so now I'm going to rant against the right for the same reason. And I guess I ranted about this before, but it just has to be said again, that the desire, the need for help is never going to go away. People are always going to want more. They're always going to want stuff, help, aid, whatever you want to call it. And so in the privacy of the voting booth, people are going to vote that way. So, hey, you in the political right, stop telling me about first principles. Stop telling me about how if only everyone understood first principles, government would be limited and small and so on. Okay, that's wrong. Okay, let me tell you a first principle. In a world full of bunnies, foxes are going to evolve. Okay, mm-hmm. Now in this case, what I'm saying here is in a productive, safe, secure country that's very prosperous, with a lot of wealth floating around, you're going to have people voting to share that wealth, distribute that wealth. It's going to happen. So they're the foxes. The productive people are the bunnies, and the foxes are eating the bunnies. Okay, it's that simple. That's a different analogy for you, Heather. Now, so what I'm talking about here is the government is going to be in the helping people business, whether you like it or not. So the only question is, how do you structure it? Now, the way it's structured right now, it's a political fight. And so it's left versus right, and nobody wins. Our country is headed towards a fiscal cliff where we can, you know, fall off that cliff and be like Greece is right now. It's happened before. It's happened many other times. It's happened every time, actually, in time. And so the question is, how are we going to stop it this time? The answer is cap and prioritize, where we maintain the purchasing power of government. And since the economy grows faster, especially when government is properly capped, the tax burden will go down over time. And in the meantime, constant prioritizing and reprioritizing will discover better and better ways to use that purchasing power so we can actually help people better. So if you're on the political right and you want limited government, you got to show how good limited government can be in terms of actually helping people the way they want to be helped on the left, which is through government action. And that's cap and prioritize. It's a big fundamental philosophical difference compared to what you've learned about first principles, but it is a truer understanding of first principles. As Montesquieu said, and as James Madison repeated, reality always wins. And right now, neither side is living in reality.
All right, so who gets thrown off the cliff? The foxes, the bunnies, or the lemmings?
Well, right now, the bunnies are being eaten by the foxes.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the analogy. And what the bunnies
have... And then
the foxes
get thrown off the cliff.
Yeah.
And nobody.
And what the bunnies have to do is say, hey, we've got some money here. Don't eat us. Don't overtax us, in other words. But let's use this money more wisely. Let's have a capped and prioritized budget. And then we can produce what the foxes want without eating the bunnies. I know, I got to work on that analogy a little bit. That's the basic idea.
And it would be nice if the bunnies are the producers. It would be really nice if there were some lemmings to follow the bunnies off the cliff, because then that would mean we were having more producers. Although, then they're in the water, so that's no good. I don't know. We're going to have to work on that.
Well, yeah, that's the right name for our movement. Prioritize the lemmings.
All right, Jay, commentary.
Cute kittens for a lemming death.
I actually, as long as we sort of keep it simple and clean, I actually like the bunny and fox analogy, the idea of the rich, which is actually, because it's sort of counterintuitive to what is being portrayed in today's media. Today's media would portray the rich as the foxes exploiting the poor bunnies, when in fact it is actually kind of twisted way the other way, in fact, the other way around. So I think that's a very apt analogy. I happen to like it. And nobody's getting thrown off the cliff, which I like, except that poor bunnies are being devoured, which, you know.
Yeah, that's no good.
No, it's no good, but it is indicative of what is going on right now.
But only 10% to 45% of each bunny, depending on your tax.
Oh.
Right.
Great.
That's all right. Only if they're chocolate bunnies will I accept that. And as long as people aren't biting the heads off, they have to leave the heads for the last.
Yeah.
I said to keep the analogy simple, and it works. And again, we've now gone off and like talked about it.
This isn't a simple topic. We can't keep the analogy simple.
No, the topic is not simple, but this piece of it, in fact, is when you're talking about sort of who is taking, in fact, from whom.
Who's on first?
What's on second?
I don't know. Third base.
That's okay. On third.
Yeah. So
naturally.
The problem with that analogy is that it starts out just fine. In a world full of bunnies, foxes will evolve. But the next step doesn't work, because the Democrats don't literally eat the Republicans. They're not cannibals, okay? But they do devour the a share of the earnings. Okay.
Okay, but why are you assuming that all producers are Republicans?
Oh, no, you're right. That's another problem here. Is the parties generally are split on this limited government versus helpful government shift. And I'll agree that the Republicans as a party, especially once they're elected, because of the political pressures on them, they don't do what they say. And so really, the Republicans are the party of talking about spending less and actually spending more. The Democrats are the party of talking about spending more and actually spending more. So either way, you're spending more. one gets to be called a hypocrite, but that's not fair, in my opinion, because really, what can they do? The political pressure forces them to do what they do. If they voted the way a purist on the right would want, they wouldn't be reelected. It just wouldn't happen, and at least not enough of the states and districts. They would be a permanent angry minority, actually like they were for many decades. So it's a tough thing, but the solution is philosophy. The solution is not the wrong philosophy. So we got to be right on the philosophy first.
Okay. Jay, what do you think about that?
I think that's exactly right. It's like anything. You're sort of building a building. You want the foundation to be solid and correct, and then you work on the details as you go along. So it is. We're back to it being a good analogy.
Oh, good. Well, at least it got Jay's approval before the end of the show.
I never didn't approve.
I just want to know who's going off the cliff.
So you have this marmot.
Grandma.
A marmot?
A marmot is my favorite animal. Okay. Just because I've actually seen marmots in the wild while I was hiking in Cascades.
In Colorado, yeah.
No, not in Colorado. In the Cascades.
I saw some kind of animal in Colorado that looked like a marmot.
Really? Well, yeah. Maybe they're here in Colorado. I haven't seen one in Colorado. Although I did a lot more hiking in Washington State when I lived up in Seattle, in the Cascade Mountains. So that's where I saw a marmot in the wild.
Okay. Cool.
And the other reason it's my favorite animal is because in The Big Lebowski, a ferret gets dropped into his bathtub, and he says, "Nice marmot." That was hilarious.
Yeah, okay. Well, they're both from the Weasley. So, yeah. Well, speaking of weasels, that's a topic for next week. But we're out of time for this week. Been a good show. Good luck, Rick, with your new lobby campaigns and efforts. Hopefully next week we'll hear a lot of good stuff about that, and maybe your green screen will actually be working.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in and listening to us on The Political Fix. We'll be back with you next week with myself, Jay Emmernick, and Rick Raddatz. I'm Heather Vail. Have a fantastic week.
Thank you for listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. On behalf of Rick Raddatz, Jay Amernix, and myself, Heather Vail, we're glad you chose to get your fix with us. We need reform to fix this country, and incentive reform is what will make a difference. The five economies and resources laid out in Pentonomics and the strategies we call cap and prioritize are the focus of Rick's vision of the optimal political future. Every week we talk about the answers we've dug up among ourselves and with political experts who have the ability to make change happen. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, at politicalfixradio.com.